Okay, let us begin then. There's a lot to do today, so we'll get right into it. If we do have time at the end, I'll point out some interesting stuff, the Chazon Ish's relationship to Yeshiva University, a few other interesting things. One thing I did want to point out last class, which I forgot, was I was speaking about the Chazon Ish's wife screaming at him. He never screamed back at her in all the years that Tzvi Yehuda was there, so it's worth noting. And also, we mentioned the Vardik and the Chazon Ish's strong criticisms of that form of Mussar. Just this week, there was a review in Haaretz of a new book that came out by Shmuel Ben Artzi called Navardik. Shmuel Ben Artzi happens to be the father of Sarah Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu's father-in-law. He is one of the last, he's 93, the last surviving members of the original Navardik yeshiva, and he wrote a novel about what it was like in Navardik. He came to Israel in 1933, Palestine. He tried to set up another yeshiva there, and then, like so many others, he was called to Zionism and the Irgun and left religion. Only recently, in his old age, has come back to Judaism. But apparently, it's a very interesting book about the whole Mussar movement, the Navardic branch of it. Okay, we stopped last class. And we began with the Chumras, and we have to do that for a few minutes and then move into his view of the state of Israel, because the Chumras is really what in many people's minds defines who the Chazon Ish is. It's had great influence, and I believe, I'll show you in a minute, that the art scroll biography of the Chazon Ish gets it entirely wrong. He did develop, as I said, a whole new series, I guess, of chumrot in the area of measurements, shiurim. I mention that because Pesach time, it's very popular. These are his most famous chumrot, stringencies, but there are many other examples. And he was not always machmir. I already mentioned last time some of his kulas. But chumrah is certainly what defines him. According to him, incidentally, all of our sukkot on sukkahs, they're all pasul. Why? Because he holds that you can't have anything holding up a sukkah, holding up the slach, which is mekabel tuma. So you can't have any metal, even a little metal piece. You can't run this sukkah, the slach, on any metal. And I think all our sukkahs have that. Other poskim would say, well, the minhag olam, the practice of the community, for years has been this way, but the Chazon Ish wasn't concerned with that. What's most significant about the acceptance, the widespread acceptance of the Chazon Ish's new standards, is that these new measurements required a rejection of hundreds of years of Jewish practices, maybe 1,000 years. After all, everyone knows how big a revit is, how big a kazayit is. Every year on Pesach, you know how much matzah you eat. So then, and everyone does it. Their parents did it. Their grandparents, the rabbis did it. And then for someone to come around though and say, "No, no, you're all wrong. We have to raise it." It's the most untraditional thing you can imagine for a religion that's supposed to be based on tradition. But it illustrates how orthodoxy can be quite dynamic and revolutionary. Now, the Chazon Ish believed in going back to the Talmud and the Rishonim and coming up with halacha. He specifically states that a posek does not need to be concerned with the majority rule, with what the previous generation of Gedolim said. To do that would make the posek a number cruncher. The Chazon Ish is an original thinker, and he really has no choice. If he comes to the conclusion that the shiur is bigger than everyone else thinks it is, that's what the halacha is. He was similar to the Gra. The Chazon Ish saw himself as following in the Gra's path. Unlike Reb Chaim, who was creating a new type of Torah, the Chazon Ish was following in the Gra's path, and the Gra himself had no difficulty going back to the Gemara and creating, bringing back minhagim, new ideas. The difference is that the Chazon Ish didn't go back to the Gemara. He went back to the Rishonim. He wouldn't disagree with the Rishonim like the Gra did. But the fact that his ideas were able to gain acceptance is of great significance. We mentioned last class the fact that the grandchildren of the Chafetz Chaim won't use his Kiddush cup anymore. It's very significant. His position of Shulchan Aruch was not like the Gra either. The Shulchan Aruch is the code. Occasionally, you can disagree if there's important Rishonim or other Achronim, but he really is bound to the Shulchan Aruch, and he wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So, really, the Vilna Gaon was the last one to really felt he could disagree with the Shulchan Aruch. The Ragat Shavar as well, but he's eccentric and isn't really mainstream. So the Chazon Ish is operating within the Shulchan Aruch tradition, no question about it. The important thing about the Chazon Ish is that he's not in a community. If you're the Rav of Kovno, you have a responsibility to all the citizens there. There's a tradition. The Chazon Ish is operating independently, which means that a community tradition does not affect him. He was the first of the great non-communal rabbis, Rabbanim, who have exercised great influence in Pesach in the last 50 years. If you look around today, all the important authorities are non-communal rabbis, even in the modern world. You look at people like Rav Schechter, who's the leading figure, and certainly the Haredi world, they're all Rashi Yeshiva, Dayanim. There are no more communal Rabbanim. The Chazon Ish is the first of the, he begins it. In the early years, in the 30s and 40s, Rav Chaim Ozer was still a Rav of Vilna. The Chazon Ish begins this pattern in which today you do not have communal rabbis being great poskim. Now we're going to see when we look at Rav Avadia in the future classes, God willing, that this is the source of Rav Avadia's great criticism of the Chazon Ish, that it's precisely because the Chazon Ish is not a communal rabbi that he can develop all these chumras, and Rav Avadia sees this as illegitimate, but not the Chazon Ish. Now, today, a yeshiva student, because of this great change, has no loyalty to the communal rabbi. We mentioned this last class. The communal rabbi has to deal with issues of, will they listen to me? Principles such as, it's better not to say something if they're not going to pay attention. The posek today, however, operating in a place like B'nai Brak or Borough Park, he can say whatever he wants to say. He doesn't have these same concerns. And his followers will follow him, whatever he wants to say, whatever he says. So the whole tradition that's been built up over centuries, this dialectic between the community, what the community will listen to and what the posek wants them to listen to, and you have to compromise. This is all throughout the Igros Moshe. Today, these concepts don't exist anymore for the poskim. They can make any decision they want because they're being led by a community, they're being followed by a community of scholars in B'nai Brak or Borough Park, and then these decisions seep into places like Cedarhurst and Teaneck, and it raises the bar. That's, in my opinion, the origin of chumras in our day and age. And it all begins with the Chazon Ish, who is such a central figure, the first central figure in Pesach, who's not a communal rabbi. Remember, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was also a communal rabbi, and he wasn't even a central figure in Pesach. All the great figures, though, were communal rabbis. The Chazon Ish is the first. I mean, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, you say he wasn't a communal rabbi, he's a Rosh Yeshiva, but remember, he saw himself as poskening for all the communities. He wasn't poskening for himself, and he wasn't poskening for a community of scholars. He was poskening for communities, for lay people. Now, I described the Chazon Ish, therefore, as revolutionary, in that halacha could be updated based on the Chazon Ish. And we'll see the same thing with Rav Avadia. Now, is this then a contradiction to his extreme conservatism? No, it's not a contradiction at all. Let me explain why. He was not striving to overturn halacha. He was striving for the correct halacha. And there's a big difference. If you look in the art scroll book, there's an art scroll book by a guy named Finkelman on the Chazon Ish. And it takes up the question of the Chazon Ish's great chumras, as everyone has to take this up. And it points to a passage in the Shla, the Kabbalistic work, Shnei Luchot HaBrit, by Rabbi Isaiah Horowitz, in the 18th century, 17th century. And the Shla speaks about, as the generations go on, as we move further away from Chazal, we should add chumras. He sees this as a pietistic thing, that adding chumras is a positive thing. We're further away from Chazal, we need more chumras. And that's how the art scroll book explains why the Chazon Ish was adding all these chumras. And I have to say that I see absolutely no evidence of any of this in the Chazon Ish. I don't think the Chazon Ish ever even held the Shla in his lifetime. He was not a makubo like the Shla. I think this is 100% incorrect. The Chazon Ish, he was an ish halacha. He wasn't using Kabbalistic reasons and therefore adding chumras on the population so they could raise their level of piety, which is what the Shla's idea was. According to the Shla, you add chumras to become more pious. The whole concept of the Shla is that you know what the halacha is, but you want to be more pious, so you find a chumra. astringency to add on to it. The Chazon Ish was far removed from this conception. When I speak about a chumrah of the Chazon Ish, I'm only speaking in relation to us. That is, we do one thing, and the Chazon Ish does something else. So I say that that's a chumrah of the Chazon Ish. But from the Chazon Ish's perspective, this wasn't a chumrah. This wasn't like the Chazon Ish was saying. You often find people saying, this is halacha, but if you're machmir, tavo olav bracha, you know, it's a good thing. The Chazon Ish thought this was the halacha. It's not like he thought that the shiurim that everyone did was fine, and he's saying be more pious. He thought that his shiurim were the halacha. And that's the pattern in all of his so-called chumras. They're only chumras from our perspective. From his perspective, that's the Ikar HaDin. He is not adding these things on for pietistic reasons. When he opposes the Heter Mechira, selling the land in the sabbatical year, it's not because he's being machmir. That's the halacha, according to him. So I think the Art Scroll book is completely wrong. And we know he didn't seek out chumras. He didn't. One of his leading followers writes as follows, describing the Rosh Hashanah minyan in his house. The Chazon Ish was not one who on Rosh Hashanah would insist that the Baal Tokeya blow the shofar blast again and again, you know, to be Yotzi for every possible shita. It was sufficient for him that the blast was halachically valid. Most years, not a single blast had to be repeated, because the Chazon Ish, his position about the shofar blast was a standard position. He wasn't looking for chumras. If he wants to look for chumras, you can come up with all sorts of ways to blow the shofar. Rav Aaron Cutler wasn't a posek. Rav Aaron Cutler really didn't look for chumra. I don't know about Rav Aaron Cutler shitas. He wasn't a posek. I mean, he would paskin, but he wasn't a posek per se. He was a Rosh Yeshiva. When he was Rosh Yeshiva, of course, he made a lot of decisions. But I don't know if he strived for chumras either. We have plenty of examples of people who strive for chumras. I mean, you have, for example, Rav Scheinberg, for example. He wears all these tzitzis. If you ever see a picture of him, he looks extremely heavy because he's wearing 100 pairs of tzitzit on him. And you have many examples of people striving for chumras. So that's not the Chazon Ish at all. No, I didn't say his chumras. I said that... There's a Kabbalistic idea. The Shlah advocates it. You find it in Rav Chaim Palachi and others, that the further away we get from Chazal, we need to add chumras for pietistic reasons, to make ourselves holier. Now, today I've heard Rabbanim say we need to add chumras because we're living in an environment of immorality, etc. We need to have chumras upon ourselves, gedarim. But that's not what the Shlah is speaking about. He's just speaking about, in general, the generations decline. And as the generations decline, we make ourselves holier by adding chumras. I mean, you can analyze this psychologically, all sorts of things. But that's not what the Shlah is about. And it's not about, that's not what the Chazon Ish is about. And the Chazon Ish is not about what we could say maximum compliance. The Mishnah Berurah's chumras are about maximum shita compliance. That is, we're not sure what the halacha is, so let's try to take into account all the possible shitas we can. That's not the Chazon Ish at all. And the Chazon Ish disagrees with the Mishnah Berurah on almost every page. And the Chazon Ish's ideology, therefore, let me make one more point about the chumras. This is a conservative ideology, in a sense that he doesn't want to. Before I say that, I want to say one more word about the conservative ideology of the Chazon Ish and move forward. This ideology, his conservative ideology. When I say conservative, I don't mean conservative in the sense that he's opposed to changing halacha. He changes halacha. He adds what he, but from his standpoint, it's not changing. From our standpoint, it is. He sees himself as very conservative in the sense that everything's growing out of the internal workings of the halachic system. Unlike others, who we'll talk about in a minute, who either are creating chumras because of pietistic reasons or kuwas because of modern orthodoxy, for him, everything comes out of the halachic system. And really, his conservative ideology as a whole became the ideology of B'nai Brak in the sense, and of the Haredi world, in opposing new approaches to Judaism. Yes, chumras were added, maybe not in accordance with his ideology, but in the larger sphere, together with the Chazon Ish's notion of Chumrah came a whole system that we don't try to change Judaism except internally. What do I mean by that? Well, let's take Yom HaAtzmaut for one. We wrote Yom HaShoah. The Chazon Ish did not believe that we had the right to institute new holidays, new days of mourning, new takanot, like Rav Herzog was doing. We have to work within the system. Everything is there internally, and if reading it internally leads me to a more stringent position, fine, that's okay, or a more lenient one. But that's not an innovation. That's simply revealing tradition, revealing Torah and the rabbis and Rishonim a new way. But we're not bringing something from the outside in. Therefore, Yom HaAtzmaut is pasul. It's forbidden. It's improper because you're taking something that's not part of the received tradition. The same with Yom HaShoah. The same with Rav Herzog's whole approach of Takanot. His ideological followers, the Stipler, Rav Shach. No, I don't think his fear was not sociological. His fear was halachic. He's an ish halacha. Just like the Rav, I'll speak about it. Their fear was not sociological. They opposed, and they continued to oppose, the Hakel ceremony. In the times of the temple, there was a great ceremony. Once every 7 years, the people gathered at the Beit HaMikdash, and the Melech, the king, would read passages from the Torah. The president of Israel, when he knows how to read, like Moshe Katsav, he happened to have a very good religious education, that he would read the Torah at the Hakel. The Haredim boycott this. They say it's pasul. And you could say, well, what's the problem? It's zecher. It's just trying to remind us of Hakel. Because it's a ceremony. It's new. The Chazon Ish, the followers, the Stipler, the Rav Shach, they write about this hatred, this opposition for ceremony. Torah is not about ceremonia. It's not about creating new things. We have a Torah. We have a halacha. Don't go create. There's no significance to a zecher hakel. If there's a chiyuv, if there's an obligation for a hakel, then you do hakel. When hakel doesn't exist, then it's meaningless. It's simply a ceremony. It has no significance. The language the Chazon Ish uses kilayim, which is a mixture of different seeds. You're taking Torah and you're mixing it with, let's say, nationalism, and that's kilayim, and that's forbidden. The very notion of making a new synagogue rich service for Yom HaAtzmaut, that's pasul. And the Rav agreed. Rav Soloveitchik strongly agreed. And he spoke against this. Rav Soloveitchik spoke against ceremonia. The only thing that's important is the halacha and what derives from it, not ceremonia. For the Chazon Ish and for the Rav, Torah, Judaism, halacha is a self-contained system, and everything must work within it. And this is quite interesting because for all the talk about the importance of the Rav for modern Orthodoxy is so defined by religious Zionism, by ceremonia, by ceremonies, by Yom HaAtzmaut. If you were to tell someone that I oppose Yom HaAtzmaut, they'd immediately assume you can't be modern Orthodox. And yet the Rav, so-called leader, putative leader of modern Orthodoxy, he was opposed to Yom HaAtzmaut. He was opposed to Yom HaShoah. He was opposed to all these things. The flip side is that this shows you that maybe we have to evaluate really how influential Rav Soloveitchik really was. He was completely ignored on these issues by modern Orthodoxy in America. The Chazon Ish was really very much like his uncle, the Brisker Rav, when it came to these things. The Chazon Ish, though, had more criticisms of the State of Israel and Yom HaAtzmaut, much more than the Rav. Apparently, the Rav went back and forth. We have different versions of this. When he was in a minyan that said Hallel, he did say Hallel. How this goes together with his ideology, I guess you could say he's saying Hallel. He would not innovate it. This is what I've been led to believe. But if the shul did it, he did it. So, for example, at YU in Maimonides, he read Hallel, and at Maimonides, he was tolerant of the people who wanted to. Apparently, at first, they didn't, and he gave in. But there's a famous story that once in Yom HaAtzmaut, they brought out the Torah, and they started carrying it around like a holiday, you know, because it's a chag, and they're making a whole ceremony. There's going to be a special Kriyas HaTorah. You know, there's a Kriyas HaTorah on Yom HaAtzmaut. If you look at the Yom HaAtzmaut Sidurim, and the Chazon Ish, the story is that the Rav starts asking, what are they bringing a Torah out for? It's not a Monday or Thursday. They're reading the Torah, and they're carrying it around. He got so angry, furious, he walked out and refused to daven with them. And, of course, they continued davening because, look, the Rav thought that, but the students didn't care. They were religious Zionists. The Rav's religious Zionism is a very strange variety. It has extremist elements together with great love for the state. And so it's very difficult to categorize him. Oh, so it's a good question. Joey asks that new fasts were instituted, the Khmelnytsky massacres. There's all sorts of cities had their own Purims and everything. The Chazanish knew this, and he said that we are not qualified to do this anymore, that in today's day and age, we don't have the authority to do this. And I'll speak about that in a minute. It's the Haredi viewpoint that in modern times, you can't do things that used to be acceptable. I'll get to that in just 1 minute. Thanks for mentioning it. Now, this is, of course, the exact opposite of the religious Zionist outlook. And the Chazon Ish, though, pointed out one more thing, which will get people upset, I'm sure. He said that, and the Rav would not say this, he says we also can't establish these holidays because we don't know what the state is going to be. When a child is born, it's called it has to be 30 days. If it dies within 30 days, there's no mourning, there's no funeral, it's called a nafel. He said the state is still at its beginnings. It could fall apart, and if you listen to people who knew him, he didn't have much faith in the state. He apparently wasn't sure, a 50-50 proposition, that the state would really survive. And so you're going to say maybe that today he'd have a different position? No, because this, I think, was just to satisfy people, maybe religious Zionists. But fundamentally, for the Chazon Ish, even if the state is strongly established, doesn't change the fact that you don't change traditional Judaism. This existence of the state has no religious significance whatsoever. It's simply a place where Jews are living, and maybe you'll be able to learn Torah there, but it has no religious significance. It can come, it can go. That's irrelevant to our religious sentiment, because there's no... And the Rav, in describing his uncle's opposition to the state, says pretty much the same thing, that there was no place in the Brisker's halachic system for such a state. Where is it? This isn't a Torah state, and if it's not being run according to Torah principles, then what value is it? It's the Rav who's innovative and tries to find value in it. Now, the Chazon Ish's ideology was therefore the exact opposite of what we sketched out with Rav Herzog and what the modern Orthodox took for granted. Remember what Rav Herzog was trying to do? He was trying to create takanot so that you could have a Torah state or as close to a Torah state as you could have. If you showed the Chazon Ish what Rav Herzog was doing, they did show him it and say, and he said he's opposed to it, but what about all the early takanot in pre-modern times? The Chazon Ish would tell you, I believe, I haven't seen in his own writings, but his followers certainly said it, that takanot are only valid for completely religious communities. When you're dealing with communities that have been influenced by outside forces that have non-religious, these takanot are not valid because we don't make takanot for those type of people. And even the rabbis are influenced by these communities, just like the Rav Herzog. He's being led to create new takanot because of the modern people, the modern Orthodox, the non-religious. So that's invalid. And this ties in with what Joey asked. In today's day and age, the Chazon Ish said, we're all influenced. We don't know what's going to be. And therefore, you cannot make new fast days. You cannot make anything new. In a ghetto, 200 years ago, before modernity, you can be sure that the Gadol had a Torah outlook. Today, we cannot institute things. You can't institute fast days, takanot. They took so long, 50 years for the Aguda, even to put one kina in for the Holocaust. And the Chazon Ish and his followers also pointed out that there's a difference between a local holiday. When you make a local chag or a local fast day, that's one thing. But to make it at a national level for all Jews to celebrate Yom HaTzimut or Yom HaShoah, that's improper. It's a violation of what Torah values are all about, he thought. Of course it hinders solving the Aguna problem because you're afraid to do anything. At the early part of the 20th century, the Sephardic Rabbanim came up with all sorts of ideas on how to solve the Aguna problem. The Ashkenazim always vetoed it because the Ashkenazim were under the influence of the Chasam Sofer's position. You can't do anything new. We're worried about the reformers. I spoke last night at YU about the Moroccan rabbis, all the interesting things they could do because they didn't have to worry about this. And there's no question it hinders if you're not willing to go out on a limb, look for a lot of solutions, because you recognize the problems of contemporary times. You're going to have lots more issues in the Aguna problem. And if you've been reading the Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post the last couple of days, the Haredi takeover of the chief rabbinate and the Dayanim, in the Chazon Ish's time, the Haredi wanted nothing to do with it. You see, why is everyone so upset? I'm surprised I haven't seen people say that the modern Orthodox and the religious Zionists, they're discriminating and they're persecutors and they're prejudiced, because as soon as Haredim get put into the position, they all of a sudden say we can't point these Dayanim. But it's true in a sense, but they're prejudiced against them because they know that these Dayanim refuse to do anything to ease the Aguna crisis. Not because these Dayanim are bad people, it's because they have a halachic tradition through Rav Yashiv, going back through Rav Shach, through the Chazon Ish, that you can't make any changes because non-religious people are not so religious or having all these problems. We don't make changes. And if you're going to say even Haredim have these problems, we do not have the authority today to make changes. We can't have the government come in and help us with get laws. You can't do the Haredim say no on all these things. And it's both a halachic position and an ideological, sociological position that in contemporary times we cannot make these sorts of changes. So you're right, it does not bode well for those who feel the halach. But the Rav himself fell back on this as well. The Rav's response, and I heard this from none other than Rabbi Raketzin in one of his tapes, the Rav's response to Rachman, Rabbi Rachman's proposal, was so over the top. Rabbi Rachman's idea of Tavol Meitav Tandu, there's no chazakah today that all women want to be married, first of all, Rachman apparently was unaware of this. There are Achronim who say pretty much the same thing. And to talk like Rabbi Rachman was trying to uproot basic Torah values when the general principle is of chazakah, presumptions change with the time. But the Rav also was very much tied to this idea that halacha cannot be changed in this way. He was not an original halachic thinker in the way that Rabbi Weinberg was or Rav Kook was. The Briskers were not. You say when the Dayanim were exclusively from the religious Zionist community, there are no innovations for Agunot. What I will say is that there were Rabbanim at least who put forth proposals. And I don't think it's true. The Willard proposal, Rav Mesas, Rav Avadia Yosef, who's not a religious Zionist, he bent over backwards for them. If you're looking for solutions, across-the-board solutions, you're not going to get it from any Dayanim. What you might be able to get are ad hoc solutions, and that the Haredim are not comfortable doing. But the religious Zionist post-scheme are more comfortable doing it. But people expect that they're going to get across-the-board solutions, a la Rachman, it's not going to happen. And the situation has been getting a lot worse for the women in the courts in Israel. And especially today, you have younger rabbis. A lot of the old religious Zionist rabbis were from the old school. They were trained in the old-time yeshivas. They just had a religious Zionist outlook. Today, you have rabbis being trained, the Tzohar rabbis, people like Rabbi Shurlo, that crowd. They're much more sensitive to issues of feminism, etc., so you really can't compare the two. Maybe you're right. Maybe the religious Zionist Dayanim won't either, but I can guarantee you that the Haredi Dayanim won't. We'll have to see where we go from there. Now, you're right, but the question is, how is it that every chazakah, the facts make the halacha? The Rav said that this is ontological, that was his word, that by definition the Torah has declared that women want to be with husbands. Well, why? Who says it's ontological? Maybe the Rav thinks it. I could have a different opinion, and why should the Rav then get so outraged? On the one hand, first of all, you could argue that the Rav is incorrect, and if you don't want to argue that, you can certainly argue that there's two approaches to this matter, but the Rav was outraged. It's the only time he chopped someone's head off in public, the way he chopped Rachman's head off, and everyone was shocked. I asked someone in the family, and he was shocked because he didn't understand why this chazaka should be so different than others, and maybe it is different, but to be so outraged at Rabbi Rachman, and as I said, you find Achronim, who basically say the same thing Rachman was saying. Not to mention the evidence. Just look on the West Side when you have women in the 20s and 30s and the 40s not married and ask them, would they marry anyone? And they'll tell you, no, they wouldn't marry anyone. So it's a very difficult position. I spoke with the Tzuravaran Soloveitchik about this, and he really didn't have an answer for it, other than that's what his brother held, and he accepted it. She's saying the main difference between the Rav and the Chazon, she's over sacrificed. I wouldn't say that, because the Rav saw Zionism as positive in that it creates a state, and we have to support it, and we can be happy about it. It's not Golos. For the Chazon Ish, this Israel is just Golos. It just happens that Jews are running it, but it's really Golos. For the Rav, it's not Golos. It's not Zionism or Rav Herzog and the religious Zionists, but it's not Golos. It has incredible significance that God enabled us to have this state, but it doesn't have any messianic significance. It has religious significance, though, in the sense that Jews fought and died for this, that God showed us that Jews are supposed to return to the land of Israel. So it's he's between the Chazon Ish and the religious Zionist world. Now, if you ask Rav Weinberg or Rav Herzog, even if you ask the Rav about something about the modern world, they'll say the modern world has a lot of good to it. They'll say that Zionism, secular Zionism, has a lot of good as well as bad. For the Chazon Ish, there's no good in the modern world, other than there's advanced medicine, but there's no ideas. Secular Zionism is not good with some bad things thrown in. It's not part of his worldview. It never should have happened. It happened, so we deal with it. It has no religious significance. In the famous meeting that the Chazon Ish had with Ben-Gurion in 1952, Ben-Gurion wanted to get to know who these Haredim are. In those days, they were a small group. They never would have agreed on this army exemption if they thought it would turn into 40,000, 50,000. In a few years, it's going to be one quarter, I think, of all, I think that's the number, one quarter. In 5 years, one quarter of all draft-age people will be getting the exemption. You can't have a society like this. It was just a few hundred. It's more, I think it was first graders. One quarter of all first graders are enrolled in Haredi-type school systems. That's what I read in Haaretz a few weeks ago. Ben-Gurion wanted to know who these Haredim were. And he wanted to meet first with the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav refused to meet with him. So they said, well, who else? Let me meet with the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish, who loved all Jews, as I mentioned last class. Unlike today's Haredi Gedolim, the Chazon Ish associated with this non-religious Jews. They came to him. He spoke to them. He knew them. He's from Europe. Today, Haredi leaders have no contact whatsoever with the non-religious. They live and they grow up and they have in a completely Haredi environment. You know, the Gera Rebbe refuses to speak to non Shabbos observers. He refuses to talk to them. He refuses to speak to them. And a typical Haredi leader never will speak to a non-religious Jew. It doesn't come into his world, and he doesn't want to. The Chazon Ish was very different. And he met with Ben-Gurion. There's all sorts of stories created by the Haredim, how Ben-Gurion refused to look at him and closed his eyes so he wouldn't see a rush. So the fact is that there were only three people at this meeting: Ben-Gurion, the Chazon Ish, and Yitzhak Navon, later the president of the state, who was at this time head of Ben-Gurion's office. And Yitzhak Navon is alive, and he gave an interview, and he told all about the meeting. So if you want to hear it from the horse's mouth, you can listen to his description that they had a heated exchange. But the idea that the Chazon Ish somehow was always looking at the ground, he refused to look at him, and it's just not true. There's so many of these stories. But the Chazon Ish met with him, because the Chazon Ish wanted to explain to Ben-Gurion, like all the Rabbanim in Lithuania, every Rav in Lithuania was elected by non-religious people, sometimes a majority non-religious. On the Jewish town councils, there were Bundists, there were communists, and the rabbi had to deal with them. Rav Chaim, for heaven's sakes, he raised money to rescue, to redeem Bundist and communist, and this is what it meant to be a European Rav, and the Chazon Ish was coming from Europe. So he met with Ben-Gurion. And the meeting also had nothing to do with drafting women to the army, which is another legend that's been. On Yom Kippur, he did what? That he did what?
He went about the davening in Shul, so they raised money to free a Bundist. He held up the davening for Kol Nidre, so people went home on Yom Kippur, got money to bribe the Russian officials.
That's right. The famous. Famous story that the Reb Chaim, for a non-religious Jew, for a communist, he did so much. So Reb Chaim was legendary for his love of all Jews. I mentioned last class, or two classes ago, when World War I started, and they came in screaming, Mashiach's going to come. The war started, and Reb Chaim says, I don't want Mashiach. if one Jew has to be killed in order to have Mashiach, I mean, for Reb Chaim, people used to ask him, why are you so lenient when it comes to Yom Kippur? The Shulchan Aruch says that if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, you eat a little bit at a time. Tachos Mikashir, and the Reb Chaim rejected that. He says, if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, eat as much as you want. So they said to him, how can you reject the Shulchan Aruch? Why are you so lenient on Yom Kippur? He says, I'm machmir on saving life. It's not that I'm lenient on Yom Kippur. I'm machmir on saving life. So at this meeting, this famous meeting, the Chazon Ish gave the analogy, which has become legendary, to Ben-Gurion. Because Ben-Gurion said, you know, we're a people also. We have our own values. And the Chazon Ish said that according to the Talmud, if two camels meet on a road, and only one can go through the path, and one is carrying products, and the other is not, that the camel that's empty has to back up and allow the others through. And the point of this was that the religious Jews... For the Haredim, they claim it meant two things. First being that the religious Jews, they have obligations, they have halachas, the non-religious Jews don't have that, therefore they have to compromise for the religious Jews. It's possible also that he was giving a dig, that secular Zionism is empty, but it's not, I don't know. I mentioned last class that the Chazon Ish knew a lot of medicine. And we know that in Europe he read Yiddish books. If you look at Rabbi Vosner from B'nai Brak, he writes about the Chazon Ish that he knew this all from the power of Torah. Through his learning of Torah, he understood all this medicine. That's seeing the Chazon Ish as a Chassidish Rebbe. And in his lifetime, he was viewed as a Chassidish Rebbe. People came from him for brachas. But the fact is, he read medical books. The Chazon Ish, people would come to him with these questions, and he'd look it up, he'd read it. But if you want to see him as a Rebbe, then you see him as having a cure for cancer. As I said, you really need to speak to someone like Rabbi Yehuda to get a real sense of who the Chazon Ish was as a person. And people would come to him for brachas and this, and he'd do his best. He'd ask him questions. He wasn't a prophet. He never claimed to have any special secrets. But you know how the masses, they turn you into that. He could have stopped the Nazis. These are juvenile Hasidic Haredi stories. That's what I would say. It's turning the Chazon Ish into a Hasidic Rebbe. Right now, the Haredi leaders have become Hasidic Rebbes. Rav Yoshev has even been giving out Shiraim. This really begins with the Chazon Ish. Before that, you didn't have this conception that the video on Google of the Chazon Ish, it's like a Hasidic Rebbe with the music. He became a Hasidic Rebbe. So look, if you want to be a believer, if you want to think that the Chazon Ish could have stopped the Nazis, that raises a real question of theodicy. If the Chazon Ish could have stopped the Nazis, and he didn't, then what type of man is the Chazon Ish? I see this as a real bizayon. You're saying that if anyone were to tell me that, it's like some Haredi guy was telling me that these Rabbanim, they're such great tzaddikim that their bones don't degrade in the grave. They don't. They remain pure. And I said to him, he's being mevazeh gedol Yisrael, and he has to do tshuva. And of course, I was very angry. I mean, I put on a show, made myself very angry, and he didn't understand what I'm talking about. He thought he was praising gedol Yisrael. He says that, 100 years you could open up their coffin, and the bodies haven't degraded. It's you can still see the bodies. And I said to him, I know for a fact, when they brought, and we even have a picture of it, the Rugachever, when they moved, they were destroying the cemetery. Rabbi Teitz arranged for, you can see pictures in his daughter's book, for the Rugachever's body, bones, to be moved. All that was left was bones. I said to him, and this rabbi had said, that true Gadol Yisrael, their bones don't decay. So I said, so you're saying that the Rugachever was not a true Gadol Yisrael? You've just been the Vaza Gadol Yisrael. You're saying the Chidah was not a true Gadol when they brought him to Israel? Yeah. So you could sort of turn it on them. If you say that the Chazon Ish could have stopped the Nazis, like some Hasidic Rebbe, you're really being the Vaza Gadol Yisrael because you're saying that the Chazon Ish let Jews die. What did he say in Toronto about the Vilna Gaon? That the bones didn't decay? I never opened up the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon's body never been moved. But that's the Hasidic thing. All I can tell you is that the... look, if you want to believe, you can believe. We're not opening them up. But I can tell you that all the Gedolim that unfortunately have been opened up, and I'm not just referring to the Rugged Shover, the bones have decayed. Because you know, it's a theological idea. I know Sfarim speak about this. You're asking me, it's a nice moral idea, but it's not an empirical idea. All the Gedolim, many Gedolim's bodies have been moved. And remember, they didn't always bury them in coffins. They buried them in shrouds. So all that's left was bones, and that's what the Gemara speaks about also, that you decay to bones. But look, if you want to be a believer, okay, continue with the Chazon Ish in the state of Israel. A few more things I need to say. He should not be called anti-Zionist. Why not? Because once the state was established, he said you have to deal with it. When we think of anti-Zionist, we think of Satmar. He's usually called non-Zionist. I don't know why anyone would say such a story. The Chazon Ish would never say such a story about himself. I mean, it's the people who view the Chazon Ish as a Hasidic Rebbe. I don't think that they say a story like that. They think of the implications. The Chazon Ish was actually asked about the Holocaust, how the Holocaust could have happened, and he said that these are one of the things that God hid from us. But I mean, if you want to be a Hasid, if you want to believe that your Rebbes can do all sorts of things like that, but I mean, I don't see why a modern educated, this isn't part of Torah, this isn't part of, I just don't see why the Haredim see the need to become, turn their people into Hasidim, Hasidic leaders, and since when has that Litvish people ever spoke like this, that their Rebbes have superpowers and they could stop the Nazis and everything? I mean, the whole thing is just very strange to me. But again, it's simply a tendency in modern times for the Misnagdim to become Hasidim, to become Hasidic Rebbes. The only person you ever heard stories like this about, that was the Vilna Gaon. Today, every single Haredi can, leader is turned into having superpowers. So, I don't know. The Chazon Ish, though, is a non-Zionist. That is, in theory, there's opposition to Zionism. You oppose the secular ideology. If it was a choice between creating a secular Jewish state or no state, you'd go with no state because you'd rather have good non-Jews than bad Jews. If it's a choice between bad Jews and bad non-Jews, some of them think you should even have bad non-Jews. The Chazon Ish said, he made a comment, whether it's a joke or not, he said that, you know, someone said, look how great the state of Israel is. He said, see if in 5 years they'll still let us go to shul. You know, he was afraid that it was going to turn into like the Jewish communists in Russia were the most anti-religious. But the fact is, once the state is accepted, you work with it, you go to Knesset, you do all these things. So therefore, we have the three ideologies. We have the anti-Zionism of Satmar we haven't dealt with. We have the non-Zionism of the Chazon Ish, which becomes the ideology of Haredi Judaism. You work with the state. You be involved with the state in order to get money for yeshivas, in order to get exemptions for your people going to the army. You try to make sure that your areas are kept totally religious. Non-religious Jews don't allow to move in. No cars on Shabbos. You work in your interest, but you're not involved in the state as some sort of ideal, as some sort of positive thing per se. And that's and then of course there's religious Zionism. Obviously, this ties into Jewish law also. For Rav Herzog, for Rav Gorin and others, they want to create a religious police force. So they're going to try to find heterim to make sure that the police force can run on Shabbos, the army. They're trying to make the public sphere as religious as you can. For the Haredi response, you know, the Chazon Ish, the state has no value per se, so we don't need to find heterim for a secular state. It has no significance. So you do have very different views in the halachic arena as well. Now, the Chazon Ish was very critical of the whole Rav Kook phenomenon, Rav Kook students. First of all, it's a form of messianism, and he didn't like that. Our job is to observe Torah and mitzvos. The Rav Kook followers thought that they knew that we're in Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, and this influenced everyone. That's the prayer for the state of Israel, says that. And the Chazon Ish said, he couldn't tolerate this. The Chazon Ish said, how do you know what the significance of our era is? Are you a prophet? You can determine that we're living in the beginning of the redemption? Jews are not supposed to think like this. They're not supposed to think of, is the Messiah coming today, tomorrow? Is this, we're supposed to observe Torah and mitzvot. Anything that takes us away from this is kilayim, that brings in false ideologies. Messianism, Cookianism, Mizrahi, it's all false ideologies. It's all pasul. The only ideology that's kosher is Torah study and observance of halacha the way it's always been done. So very conservative. Another way we can see his traditionalism, his conservatism in halacha, is how he used manuscripts. The Munich manuscript of the Talmud, the Meiri, new Sfarim. The Chazon Ish believed that we can't bring these new Sfarim in. There are a few exceptions in his writings when he thought it was, you know, basic concepts. But the general rule is that you don't use the Meiri to decide halacha. You don't use a newly published Sefer. We can only use those Sfarim that the Vilna Gaon had, that the Chasam Sofer had, that are part of the halachic tradition. Because he says, Hashkacha Pratit, Providence, a little mystical here, Providence has decreed that these Sfarim be part of our tradition. It's not just practical, utilitarian, that these Sfarim were out of the tradition. God set up things in such a way that certain books were in and others were out. The Rav was also of the CU, and I will tell you, that's correct, that this CU has not been accepted. The Haredi world, even, has not accepted. The Chazon Ish has his followers in Chazon Ish, but the Haredim as a whole have embraced this publication of new Sfarim. So that's interesting. There's another position of his, though, which has been accepted by the Chazon Ish, by the Haredi world, and it's been very influential just in the last few years, and that is to give significance. Great significance to all Agadot, Agadah and the Talmud. Agadah, from the medieval rabbis, I'm getting to electricity in just a minute. For Agadah, from the medieval rabbis, yes, Rashi and the rest took them very seriously. There's a whole Spanish school, though, that saw them as more of spur-of-the-moment comments. Take them if you want. You're not bound to them. The Ramban in the same famous disputation. The Chazon Ish said that all Agadot originate in the sage's prophetic or quasi-prophetic power. And this is very different than all these Rishonim that spoke about how you don't really need to take all Agadot seriously. If you learn something from it, that's good. Otherwise, it was said by a preacher, it's not prophetic. Is this not an, I don't think it's an innovation. I think this is it's not an innovation. The Maharal certainly held it all Agadot, and that's why Rav Azariah DeRossi, his books were put in Chayrem. I have no doubt that the Rishonim in Ashkenaz held all Agadah. It's the Rishonim in Sfarim was a fundamentalist, a maximalist in this regard, and it's the famous letter is Volume 1 of the Igros Chazon Ish, Number 15, addressed to none other than Tzvi Yehuda, who we spoke about so much when he started going off the derech. And when I say going off the derech, he went to Yeshiva University, you know, so now he's a rabbi doctor, but that, you know, he started having doubts about Agadah. Do we really need to take all these things? And you see this letter, which is a very sharp letter, telling Yehuda that once you begin questioning, you're knocking down the fundamentals of the Torah. And this really is where Das Torah really builds off from this so much. When you're talking about the Rishonim, like the Chazon Ish, when you're saying that a view advocated by Rishonim and Achronim is pasul, it's out of bounds, you're not saying I don't accept it, you're saying it's out of bounds, well, what gives someone the authority to say that? It's one thing to say I hold one way, and then there's another position, but he's saying it's out of bounds. What gives him the right to say that? And for people to accept that, it's because he had Das Torah. When you have Das Torah, this idea that you have this quasi-prophetic insight into the Torah, that gives you the authority to disqualify views that used to be acceptable, and even label heretical views that used to be regarded as acceptable. Because if you look to the sage today, he has Das Torah, and he can tell you that these views, even though they were stated by Achronim or Rishonim, are no longer acceptable. That's how Slifkin can be banned. Even though Rishonim, Achronim held his view, the contemporary holders of Das Torah, they can determine that the views are no longer valid. And the Chazon Ish, in this famous letter, and other letters, really give the justification for this whole Das Torah phenomenon. He had a real intuitive sense. Is it not an innovation? Das Torah, I believe it's an innovation, but not to the extreme. That it's an innovation in the sense that they don't even try to justify it agadically. I think it's wrong to say that it's a complete innovation, as many have said, because you have, for a long time, you have people trying to argue based on Agadah, policy positions. What's the innovation, perhaps, is that today the Gedolim don't even feel the need to justify it. They just state their opinion ex cathedra. But the idea that the Gedolim had power over non-halachic matters is not a complete innovation. I think people who think that Das Torah is a completely new concept, it's a misreading, and that Das Torah has ancient roots, with changes, of course, over time. Now, the Chazon Ish had a real intuitive sense for the halacha. He supposedly coined the phrase that there's a fifth order of Shulchan Aruch. That is, there's many things that don't look good. You have a sense that it's wrong, and you can't exactly point to a siman in the Shulchan Aruch. You know it's wrong. It's the fifth order of the Shulchan Aruch. When some were trying to find heterim in the early years of electricity, they were trying to assign heterim in certain circumstances. The Chazon Ish said, what we need to do is not to find a heterim for electricity. It's not that electricity, the isser of electricity, is established firmly, and therefore we can start looking for a terim. On the contrary, we need to establish the electricity firmly. Common sense, yeah, the fifth phallic is common sense. That is, you can see that something doesn't, but it's not just common sense like the Balabas common sense. It's the common sense, the intuitive common sense of a Gadol B'Torah. His common sense comes from his Torah insights. So the Chazon Ish said that we must establish proofs to base the issur of electricity on. And he knew this from an intuitive sense, as I'll explain right now. He explained that all technology runs on electricity. And in the future, everything is going to run on electricity. So if we start making a terim and permitting it, there are going to be no Shabbos left. There are two elements to Shabbos we all know, Zachor and Shamor. He was referring to the Shabbos spirit. And he's entirely correct. I think usually you think of meta-halacha considerations driving you in the direction of kuvot, to leniencies. But here, it's really in the direction of stringencies. In his day, if you said that electricity is a danger for Torah, for Shabbos, I think no one would understand what you're talking about. I mean, if all electricity meant was turning on lights, big deal. I can tell you that our Shabbos would not be affected one iota, in my opinion, if we turned on lights on Shabbos. However, if you could turn on lights on Shabbos, then everything's permissible. Then TV's permissible. Now, if TV's permissible, that's the end of Shabbos. No more Shabbos. People would finish a Shabbos meal and immediately go, like every other night of the week, and sit in front of the TV. Friday night would everyone be watching TV like every other night of the week. If you've ever been, as I have, in a non-Shomer Shabbos house on Shabbos and you hear the television in the background, you know there is no Shabbos. So, Chazon Ish had such insight to realize that even though you might say, well, big deal, electricity in this case wouldn't affect the Shabbos, that if all of a sudden you take a thing like a radio, television, you would no longer have Shabbos anymore. It wouldn't exist. We don't permit use of a Shabbos clock to watch TV for the same reason. We know that it'll destroy the Shabbos spirit. You might not violate Shamor, but you violate Zachor, vice versa. But there's still some areas, I will say, that are in the middle, that haven't been yet settled, and the Orthodox community will on its own come to them. We pretty much have all accepted that you can use Shabbos clocks for lights, even though Ramosha was opposed to them. We have all accepted you can't use Shabbos clocks for television. But what about in the middle, using a coffee maker timer to go on Shabbos morning? My sense is, I don't know if Rabbi Kelman may speak to it, that most poskim actually permit it. And Rabbi Haber of Muncie had a big thing about it. The Tzitzel Yezer has a thing permitting it. It's hard to say, but these are one of the areas that it could be that the people, the ritual instinct of the people, will say that, no, you can't use this sort of thing, even though the poskim might say it's permissible. It remains to be seen. In his book on the Shabbos, Yaakov Katz speaks about things that technically are permissible. The rabbis could have permitted or would have, but the ritual instinct, this fifth order, said that you can't do it. And what did he conclude? Or he just spoke about it. But it's a machlokes, like everything else. It's a machlokes.
It's a machlokes, but there are many who are matir. There are many who are matir, even putting in food in the oven. You want to have hot food and have a timer go on your oven, but okay, for another time.
So, I mean, Chaim Soloveitchik pointed out famously, was mentioning it because it's the kosher season, the Pesach season. Kosher for Pesach is obviously not Pesach dick. according to the Shulchan Aruch, you can serve dairy on a meat plate if it's cold. You know, serve cold cuts on a dairy plate. So there's this ritual instinct, though, which is important. And the Chazon Ish spoke about that. It's hard to explain why electricity is forbidden. The Chazon Ish argues that it's boneh. You're completing a circuit. So the formerly useless wire is now functional. And this is similar to completing a building or putting something together made of numerous parts. I don't think in pre-emancipation, in policy pronouncements, you're right. It was shared between the communal leaders and Rabbanim. In fact, in many places, the Rabbanim were forbidden to make policy decisions without the approval of the community. They couldn't put anyone in Cherem in Italy without the approval of the community. You're right, but that's the community paid their salaries. And I think the rabbis would tell you, though, that that's not a good thing. That's that they had no choice. Now, Baruch Hashem, they're separated from the community, so they can really do what they want to do. Us in the community, maybe it was a good thing when we kept them on a tight leash, but it's a very different situation now. The Chazon Ish's view on electricity was shared by virtually no one. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach explains that closing a circuit is like an opening. It's like opening and closing a door. Since the door is open and closed all the time, there's no you're not violating anything. It's the same with a circuit. Other poskim argued that electricity is forbidden because it's like a fire, or it's you're cooking. You're cooking the electricity, or it's makib patish, you're finishing up something. What I can say is, and I don't want to sound like a maskil saying it, this was said recently by Rav Asher Weiss, who's a big rav in Posek in Israel. He said it, so if you think it sounds like a maskil or an academic scholar, know that Rav Asher Weiss said it. He said that from all the different justifications given to why electricity is forbidden, what this shows you is that instinctively the poskim knew it was forbidden, but they didn't know what category to put it in. They were all trying to find a category because they knew instinctively from this fifth order of Shulchan Aruch it didn't fit in with Shabbos. But how to asser it? That was the problem. So it's almost like a Das Torah sense involved in halacha, but that's Rav Asher, and I think he's correct. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, though, interestingly enough, he didn't share this view. He held that electricity is not per se is not a problem. There are problems with using electricity in an incandescent light because you get heat and light. And that's not good if it's great heat and also light. And he explains why. But if you're just going to have, let's say, a radio on Shabbos or a telephone or putting on a fan, according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, there's nothing halachically wrong with it. But he says that the minhag is to forbid it. And that's what the rabbinic authority said, and therefore we must continue along this path, but really there's nothing wrong with it. What this means is, and Rabbi Jachter, of course, could elaborate, he wrote a very nice article years ago on electricity, is that when you have Shas Hadchak, when you have difficult circumstances, you can go with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's opinion, and you can create all sorts of options that you couldn't with the Chazon Ish. I mean, Rav Shechter, during the hurricane, for example, a few years ago, he gave instructions on how to use the radio on Shabbos, and, you know, the whole, because it's not, it's the Rabbanon, so, you know, if you need it, you can need it. Rav Abadi, here's another post-sake who's not afraid to give his opinions on matters. He writes that if your clock radio goes off on Shabbos and it's making all this noise, it's disturbing your Shabbos, and I'm assuming the same would be if a kid turns a television on, you can turn it off with a shinoi. Not a d'oraisa, it's a d'rabbanan, and you're disturbing your Shabbos rest. He says that if you see that you forgot to set your, you turn off your timer. You know, you every morning you get up at 6 a.m. and you see the little green light is on that's going to wake you up Shabbos morning. You can turn it off. What are you doing? All you're doing is this little green light is disappearing. What's the malacha? What's the isser? We don't do it, but it's a choice. It's going to destroy Shabbos. It's going to wake you. I mean, so the only way you can come to these decisions is by taking Rav Shlomo Zalman's position. Now, I think that we, Ravadi says you can carry a baby monitor with you on Shabbos and even adjust the volume level. I think most of us recoil from these sort of heterim. But as Rav Shlomo Zalman explained, it's really hard to explain why these heterim are forbidden. I don't, even these posts can say you don't do it, but under times you need to do it. And I'll give you another example. Where the minhag, we have a minhag of not using electricity, but I know someone who went on one of these cantor's cruises. He's from cruises. And they get on the cruise and they find out that all the toilets are electric. What are you supposed to do? Well, there was a rav on board who gave dafyomi every day, and he had checked out before the cruise with a big post egg in Israel, and the halacha was with a shinoi. You flush the toilet with a shinoi. okay, I think that's no big deal. If you're it's Covenant Briot, you're on the ship. But I think there's the question, then, what gives you the right to go on the ship in the first place? Maybe you're going to say, like the Chazon Ish would say, since you're going to be put in a situation, don't go on in the first place. Once you're already there, the Chazon Ish would say with a shinoi. That means you do it with a left hand, backwards hand, it becomes a derabana, and you could do it. But don't go on the ship in the first place. The answer is no, you don't need to. Now, what's going to happen if all our toilets one day become electric? I think and that's the only way we can do it. I think the post scheme are maybe going to have to look at the issue again, have to start out using shinoids. Although maybe we have all these entrepreneurs now, they'll create Shabbos toilets, Grumma toilets. Like we have, there's a guy in my town who has a Grumma wheelchair, and we have a Grumma phone in our shul. If there's an emergency, you use the Grumma phone. So the hotel room keys on Shabbos are different because you can always ask a non-Jew worker to go up and open them for you. If you didn't have a non-Jew worker and you were stranded outside, that would be, I guess, a parallel case. But you can usually ask a person to open it for you, and so that's not really... although the issue hasn't yet. Look, that's the issue. You have to ask a poskim about it. All the times I've asked, they always have said, and I've asked this question, that try to find a non-Jew to open it for you. And bottom line is you're not supposed to be carrying the key. So it's supposed to be at the front desk. So when you go to the front desk, you ask the person. If you're in no other choice, yes, I believe all these poskim who agree with the Shlomo Zalman would say, do it with a shinoi or whatever. No, not five times a day. You ask him, I did it once when I was in Florida. I told this guy, I gave him a $20 bill. I said, this is because he's a doorman. I'm going to be asking you to do a lot of favors for me over the next Sabbath. And, he was very happy to do it. You know, you got to, look, you do what you can do. I know it's become very hard with the electric keys. Since we're in the Pesach season, let me just conclude with something. And another incredible chumrah. I've been communicating now with Rabbi Yehuda, and he told me that the Chazon Ish would only eat matzah on the first night of Pesach. He would not eat matzah any other night. The first night, it's a mitzvah. As long as it's not running around. Well, in hotels, you always have people out there. The Chazon Ish said the Chazon Ish himself would only eat the first night when it's a mitzvah. Now, what about Shabbos, the rest of the time? You're supposed to have bread. He was so concerned that there might be it might have been made wrong. This wasn't a chumrah in the sense that he's telling other people to do it. This was his own personal stringency. And it's not something he wanted other people to follow, but it gives you a sense of the man that to go so far, that means you can't even make hamotzi on Shabbos. It's quite interesting. In any event, let me just conclude by saying that unlike Rav Herzog, the Chazon Ish's influence has really grown and it continues to grow. It's the basis for it's really the basis for the chumrahs. Simcha Elberg in the 60s wrote about this, from B'nai Brak, the Chumras really begin with the Chazon Ish. It's the basis for the posek outside the communal framework. It's the basis for the Haredi ideology of the State of Israel, the viewpoint that it has no inherent religious significance, and that Torah study is really our only value. So I hope that this was of insight to people. I do want to say that, Rabbi Kelman saying it, I feel honored I was asked to even continue with the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Moshe, and Rav Adi Yosef, and we will continue. And one more thing, let me just say to all of you, all my new friends online, I think this says something. I think most of us, or all of us, are what we would call modern Orthodox, so I think it says something very important about us. Obviously, we have faults, but one of the Haredim have a fault which we don't have. The fundamental flaw, in my opinion, of Haredi ideology is that they can't appreciate shivim panim. They can't accept gedolim and not in their camps. They can't appreciate them. And the one great thing about the modern Orthodox, the religious Zionist, is that they can appreciate. We can sit and study the Chazon Ish and appreciate his greatness, even if we don't accept all of his ideas. And we'll do the same with the Satmar Rav. Whereas in the Aguda world, they can never have a session on Rav Herzog. They can never have a session on Rav Kook. They just can't do it. And that, as I said, is the real fundamental flaw of Haredism. So I think that's something, at least, that the modern Orthodox religious Zionists can be proud of. Okay, if there's any questions, I'll just tell you quickly what I want to tell you in this book. My Yeshiva College, some of you might have seen it. It's a very interesting book, Recollections of the... It's not, if someone would have written my Columbia College, it really wouldn't have significance, but my Yeshiva College, because Yeshiva College is the history of Orthodox. orthodoxy. Alvin Schiff talks about when he was in high school, when he finished high school, he was going to go to yeshiva. They didn't know Chaim Berlin, YU. They weren't sure where to go, Torah Adas. So he's a cousin of someone who was very close to the Chazon Ish. And I asked the Chazon Ish, now understand, Rav Chanan Wasserman was an extremist. He refused to step foot into Yeshiva University when he came to America. The Chazon Ish, however, he could be very extreme for himself and for others, but not for everyone. He didn't have this. He sent back a letter, and Schiff still has it, in which he says, Avramelo, that's how he was known, go to Revel's Yeshiva. You know, just be careful that you're studying all the secular stuff. Wear a warm coat. Wear a warm coat means that you're going to be in a colder environment. You need to continue your learning Torah so that you keep yourself warm. The fact that the Chazon Ish was able to give this sort of advice because he was told what type of kid this was. Rav Chanan Wasserman told people in the 30s, as a famous case, I have the letter, not to go to America because a physical danger in Europe is better than a spiritual danger at YU or Skokie. Now, he didn't say this once the war began, when it was real pikuach nefesh. I don't think he would have. But in the 1930s, when people were trying to get out, and there was a possibility of danger, the Chazon Ish said, better the possibility of danger in Europe than the danger in America. Not the Chazon Ish, Rav Chanan Wasserman said that. And here you have the Chazon Ish telling someone, go to YU, because I'll read you the exact word he said. I think someone might find it of interest. He says, I think that's a good idea for you to study in Revel's Yeshiva, and you can learn a study for a trade or a profession in the secular department. So there's so much simplicity written about simplistic ideas about the Chazon Ish. He was a very complicated person, and he was a great one, and that he was able to recognize what's for him and his followers wasn't necessarily the right idea for everyone. He was asked about the Ezra groups from Germany that came to Israel, the co-ed groups, the exact same question Rabbi Weinberg was asked. And he said the same thing Rabbi Weinberg said, don't touch them. They're being successful. So you have here a very extreme gadol in a certain way, but one who's also open-minded and sees that the different communities have different approaches. So really an incredible figure. At least I hope I was able to touch on his greatness in these two classes. Comment, yes.
Reb Jay and Reb Shlomo for this course, because it's been for me more than interesting. It's really been somewhat life-changing in that I was not raised religious, and I went to Haredi Balchuv yeshivas, and I was uncomfortable about what was going on there, and they told us, no, this is the way this religion has to be, because all the gedolim are Haredi, and now I'm saying that that's not true at all. And some of the people you've talked to us about, like Rav Herzog, who I knew nothing about, Rav Cook, who I knew only a little about, and Rav Hirsch, it's been just tremendous for me to know that they're out there, and it's really freed up the religion and made it very sweet for me. So I really, really want to thank you for that.
That's good. Thank you. And there's a lot more. Rabbi Roth, look, I understand what you're saying, which is why I said that before I quoted Rabbi Weiss, that it sounds a little Haskalah, but the Chazon Ish himself said that we need to find the prohibition upon which to base it. So it's almost as if he's acknowledging that he knows it's usur, but he can't say why it's usur. And from a Haredi perspective, to say it's subjective, that's not a problem, because the ultimate Haredi value is that the Gedolim, through their internal sense, the fact that they can sense it's usur, that's more important than saying that they can even point to a siman in Shulchan Aruch. That's overpowering. That's the Das Torah of the Gadol. So the Chazon Ish might not be able to find the exact reason why it's forbidden, but he knows it's forbidden. So I understand, though, it is subjective in a sense. That's what Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he just looked at it halachically, and he wasn't convinced. But so I don't know, from our perspective, when you look at it this way, it weakens the prohibition. How could you say, Rabbi Roth, that, as you said, that there are a number of reasons for the prohibition, and he's just articulating the reason he sees it. Because if you look at the reasons, Bona? Makibapatish cooking because you're cooking the wires? Since when is that cooking? I mean, they're really stretching it. Rosh Hashanah Arbach says that they're stretching the Isurim to such a level, to cook a wire, these appear to be stretches, which is why Rabbi Weiss said that they were trying to find the category into which to place it. And why Rosh Hashanah Arbach says that basically none of these are good, but we know that it's important not to use electricity. And in a sense, I think the fact that we could Shabbos clocks, would any of us dream of setting a Shabbos clock on Shabbos, even if it was permissible? Of course not, because it would destroy Shabbos entirely. So I would say it doesn't even have to be forbidden from the standard of electricity. There's a whole idea of Shamor. We have to make the Shabbos that violates Shabbos in a much more fundamental sense than a technical violation. So I don't know, but you're right. It's a problem, but it's not the only example of Gedolim who have a sense that something is Mutter or Usser, but can't exactly locate where it is. You open a can of worms. Of course you open a can of worms, but if you ask the Haredi figure, what does the Chazon Ish mean, he would say it's not subjectivity. I think he would say it's the Das Torah. Das Torah is not subjective. Das Torah is using your Torah sense. So when, for example, the Gadol says you should do this, he can't point to a simon in the Shulchan Aruch. You might say, well, this is his subjective outlook, and therefore I disagree. But they would say it's not a subjective outlook. It's his Das Torah evaluating the reality of the situation, and therefore he declares that you must vote for this party in the Israeli election. It's not subjective. It's Das Torah. So Das Torah is not subjective. The fact that you're using the word subjective shows that you're biased against Das Torah, I guess we could say. That's what I think you have to answer it. I don't know. Maybe the Chazon Ish would disagree with what Rabbi Weiss said, but he did say that we have to establish the prohibition, and he did say that we have that there are intuitive senses as a fifth order of Shulchan Aruch. So I don't know. This is an issue. Many people have mentioned this about electricity. The same comment. So, okay, any other questions or comments? Well, thank you.
All right, thank you, everybody.
Okay, just one more thing about not having kids have to do with his marriage. No, because, look, he didn't have the greatest marriage. We know that. But what does that have to do with having children? There's a mitzvah to have children. I don't think there's any reason. Certainly he wasn't abstaining from a mitzvah. Because, as Tzvi Yehuda said in discussing the marriage, he said, really, a lot of European marriages were like this. These were shiduchim. These were not romantic marriages. And then Yehuda, though, pointed to some yeshivish marriages which were wonderful marriages, or Mrs. Al Meltzer's marriage. So to say that Chazon Ish's marriage, it was a typical European marriage, so that's not a reason not to have children. Yeah, Weinberg slept in the shul, but he's a much more modern person, and he wanted something very differently. Okay, look, this was a lot of fun. I learned a lot from your questions and comments, and we will... I will send you that info tonight. I think you probably should invite him, maybe just to give one lecture, growing up with the Chazon Ish, get it on tape for posterity. It probably would be, and I asked someone from Israel, who he once spoke about this at the Hebrew University, and he said he actually is a very good speaker, and so I'll give you the information. You could take it up with him and think if it's worth it or not.
Well, I just sent Mark a thing on Tzvi Yehuda. We should invite him for Torah Motion in Toronto. Because I didn't send that to us, so that's why the people may not know what we're talking about. Anyway, I want to thank you for the very enjoyable lectures. I want to thank everybody for coming. I want everybody to bring at least one friend, like next time, so we can double our time. That's everybody's job. Come back to Brooklyn. I want to wish everybody a Chag Shabbos Sameach. And thank you very much, Joey. I will speak to you anyways after you email you. And thank you very much. And everybody, thank you for sharing the Sameach. And we'll see you soon. We just a cute thing. We were thinking we may be starting on Monday night. And the first Monday night was going to be Yom HaTzmaut. And the Sefer Revi is the beginning of the lecture. But we decided to push it off a week, although I'm very tempted to have a lecture on the Sefer Revi.
We still talk about the schedule. Okay, I'll talk. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for everything.
Bye.